To round out the morning, I'm going to invite Kenley Sequese, who has kindly agreed to stand in for Brian West, to moderate the next panel, which is the consumer perspective. And I've been asked by the organizers if all members of that panel could come up to the podium because for the taping. All right. Quick comment, question, Ruben, while we're getting together.
Well, I just wanted to react to to that really nice presentation. I just have two comments. I'm Ruben Granch. I'm from UNAIDS. One thing is that I think we need to think about the definition of tasks. And so I'm fairly certain that I followed your talk, fairly certain you were focusing on the treatment for the prevention of transmission. But actually, WHO defines tasks as treatment for the prevention of HIV and TB illness, death, and transmission. And so that change in frame actually changes a lot of the ethical considerations, because in those situations, you're actually treating somebody. And as you see the guidelines get earlier and earlier, in the end, hopefully this discussion will actually become moot, because you'll be offering treatment to for illness and for death. And then the other thing I just wanted to offer, I'm sorry to delay but the other thing I wanted to offer is that at UNAIDS we've had a shift, and we're in the process of shifting from a perspective of a right not to be treated and a right not to have testing, and kind of that in that negative space, to one where it's a right to testing, a right to have treatment, a right to protect others, and also a right to be protected. So in other words, and be protected, that deals with the discrimination and the and all of the negative things and stigma that can happen. But the other three rights are very, very important, and we're shifting that frame. And I think you'll just watch that space, and you'll see a new position from UNAIDS in that area. But anyway, I really enjoyed your talk. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for those comments.
Thank you very much. And actually, Brian is here with us. So without further ado, very happy to introduce Brian West, who is the chair of the European AIDS Treatment Group. He's a medical writer, HIV advocate, is involved in promoting the sexual health and well-being of people living with HIV in Scotland and across Europe.
Thank you very much for being here today. I am indeed Brian West. I am still here. Thank you very much. The session today is called Implementing TASP, the Consumer Perspective. And it's really very interesting, I think, that it's called the Consumer Perspective, because on this stage there are quite a few consumers. Over the last 18 years for me, I have been consuming bucket loads of antiretrovirals without a break since December 1996. Next month, in fact, October, sees me being 30 years since I was infected with HIV. In those 30 years, we've seen massive, brilliant, incredible advances. I've lived through a time when HIV was a death sentence. I've lived through the time when Lord Fowler's government was putting leaflets through our doors warning us of the dangers of AIDS. I've lived through all of that, and I managed to survive just long enough to have antiretrovirals coming through. I also remember a time when treatment was for opportunistic infections, and that was no picnic either. I remember ganciclovir implants for CMV in my eyes. It was horrible. And I think that's very important to have some kind of history here, because at one point in 1998, I was taking four 100-milligram tablets of ritonavir twice a day with four 100-milligram tablets of sequinavir and two 40-milligram tablets of D4T or stavudine. It was not an easy regime to take. It was, to be perfectly honest, in terms of side effects, rip-roaring. I don't want to go back to that. And I think that kind of explains why we are here today. We would not be here today talking about treatment as prevention if we did not have drugs that were very easy to take, if the truth be known, certainly compared to what we used to have, and drugs that are incredibly tolerable. They're very good drugs that we have, and that's why we've got to where we are today. I also think it may be helpful, because I haven't heard one yet so far, just to have some kind of rough definition of what we mean by treatment as prevention. By treatment as prevention, I think we're talking about the provision of antiretroviral therapy to a person living with HIV to reduce the risk of transmitting HIV through sex to protect our own health. After discussion, if a patient wishes to start antiretroviral therapy to reduce the risk of transmission, then treatment would be given before it would be normally recommended for their personal health according to national guidelines. I think that's kind of quite important because we had a discussion over the past 2 days looking at treatment at 500 and some people talking about test and treat. This isn't actually test and treat, and that's a very important issue in terms of us discussing it with policymakers. Financially, it is actually quite different from test and treat. For us at the EATG, the European AIDS Treatment Group, which I'm the chair of, we were very, very fascinated and interested when we heard about treatment as prevention, and we had a few reservations about it. Our reservations being that treatment as prevention could take treatment away from people living with HIV who needed it for purely clinical reasons. We also felt that people could feel pressured into taking antiretroviral therapy, viewed as infectious agents rather than human beings who were actually part of the solution. And we were also concerned that treatment as prevention could take money away from budgets that are under pressure all the time, prevention budgets, and that we could see money being taken away from behavioural interventions. There are some indications that this has happened in some places. Doesn't mean to say that we should be wary of TASP, but we should be aware of it. So coming to our panel today, we have a presenter, first of all, Gus Cairns from NAM and the European AIDS Treatment Group. And then we have some panellists, Cornelius Baker from FHI 360 in Washington, Anna Zakovic from the Global Network of People Living with HIV, Nikos Dedis from Positive Voice, Athens in Greece, and Kelly Sikwezi from the African Community Advisory Board from Lusaka in Zambia. I'm very sorry, but Paul Kasonomoka could not make it here today. Thank you. Anyway, I'll hand over to Gus. Gus is one of these really interesting people in terms of HIV in the UK. With me, he's a member of the HIV Dinosaurs Club. The only difference between us and the real dinosaurs being that we did actually survive the impact with the asteroid or the meteor, whatever it was. Thank you. Gus.
Okay. I'll explain a little bit about the background of this presentation, though I hope not to take too much time. We had a meeting yesterday morning before the main conference of 50 treatment activists, largely from Europe. And our focus was, because we wanted a focus, a statement that that EHG initially wrote, but which we hope to turn into a kind of community consensus statement that other HIV organisations can sign on to, which attempts the near impossible task of crunching together all the numerous ethical, political and medical issues involved in treatment as prevention in a single two-page document and stating them as a kind of series of principles that should be adhered to. So good luck with that. Anyway, so this is essentially the presentation that I gave to that meeting yesterday, plus a summary of the feedback that we got from that meeting. Now, I apologise because some of this is a few slides detailing the background and the science and why we need treatment as prevention. So some of this will be terribly familiar to some of you, but I'll try and get through those ones as quickly as possible. Okay, so we have a tremendous amount of possible HIV prevention options open to us. Some are old, some are new, some are potential. This is essentially a kind of summary of the results from most randomized controlled trials or important meta-analyses of RCTs of different prevention methods, the exception being the studies of condom, the 100% attempted condom use, which inevitably have to be observational. You'll notice a couple of things that I want to draw attention to. I can't go into the whole detail of this. The efficacy of these, or they are efficacy because they are largely RCTs, ranges from 0 to 96%. And I think one particular interesting one is the red bars, which are the PrEP trials. And again, the efficacy ranges from 0, as seen in FemPrEP and Voice, to 96%, which was the estimated efficacy of regular, and that means at least 4 days a week, PrEP in IPREX. And, of course, we know why there's such a variation in efficacy in PrEP, and also this applies to treatment and prevention too. It's all about adherence, and adherence is all about whether people want to take their pills or not and feel able to do that. And so that's a very important factor in treatment and prevention, though by no means the only one. That's just to show I know what I'm doing. This, of course, is the challenge, that despite having had HIV treatment for a long time, certain populations, HIV is no longer... has never really decreased, and that's partially... that's for all sorts of reasons. I like to do this slide because it puts the UK and French HIV diagnoses in recent years next to each other, and essentially they're almost superimposable, which to me suggests a kind of common cause as to why, for instance, HIV infections are not going down in gay men. Why? Well, one of the reasons is because HIV prevention in the pre-heart era was terribly simple. You know, you used a condom or you didn't, basically. But as soon as ART came along, that became a real challenge, I think, for people who were infected with HIV or who were at high risk for it. And, I mean, I'm not singling condoms as the only method that people had to reduce their risk of HIV, but they were very highly kind of focused on as the thing that the community owned and used, as it were. If you take it, this is a longitudinal data set from the gay men's sex surveys in the UK, which is one of the longest data sets we have on gay men's prevention or gay men's behaviour, although it's very important to note that they're not the same people every year. If you take it from 1993, which was pre-ART, you can definitely see an increase in unprotected sex. If you take it from 1998... The situation is less clear. What we may be seeing is a kind of a stuck state, a kind of homeostasis of a particular community that is kind of stuck between the fear of HIV and STDs and the dislike of condoms or whatever condoms symbolise to people. Why? And so as a result, HIV prevention has become a tremendously complex task for people both with and without HIV who are at risk of it. I'm certainly not going into the detail of this study. It's one of the most complex I've ever had to crunch for AIDSMAP, to the extent that I actually went back to the researcher and said, what does your study mean? And she said, oh, well, I'll have to go back to my own paper and tell you. But basically, the guys at the Green... This is 3 years of data from very large national studies of gay men in Australia. The guys in the green at the bottom are the kind of safest ones, ranging from people who don't have sex at all to the olive green bars, which are people who attempt to use condoms 100% of the time. Still the most popular prevention choice, but not the majority one. Up to various sorts of negotiated safety arrangements in the orange, up to pretty much no strategy other than crossing your fingers and hoping up at the top. Okay. Another challenge, of course, is getting the treatment to the people. You'll be seeing umpteen versions of this. I do apologise for showing you another one. This is actually last year's UK treatment cascade as presented by Valerie Delpech at the last meeting. And yesterday, Jane Anderson presented one saying that, suggesting that the UK... proportion of people with HIV who are undetectable in the UK is now 58%, so we're doing better. And guidelines. One of my personal hopes and perhaps guiding principles, and which might resolve some of the dilemmas that Jeremy Sugarman, who was showing in his brilliant presentation, I was watching that and thinking, do I need to make a presentation at all, is that ultimately treatment will be treatment as prevention. They will become the same thing. As the drugs become more tolerable, as the clinical evidence for... I suspect that the clinical evidence for people with HIV benefiting from being on treatment generally will become stronger. And then you're kind of left with the issues to do with inequity, allocation, that he was talking about and which will still be very very important. At the moment, I think the treatment guidelines in are a bit of a mess. Some take a sort of essentially a treat-everyone approach. Others still use CD4 counts. I think the three that use CD4 thresholds have various definitions. Actually, the EACS one has since been updated. I forgot to update this slide. I think it's very important not just to talk about couples, however, because the people who spread or contract HIV are very often not people in couples, unless a couple is two people having sex in a sauna for 5 minutes, which, of course, it is in terms of infection pairs. But we need to extend treatment as prevention to everybody. Incidentally, I would like to come out at this point. Now, Brian outed me as a person living with HIV, which I guess you kind of assumed. I would like to out myself as a person who might personally have benefited from treatment as prevention, and so would my partners. In a period between 1990, when a partner of mine died of AIDS, and 1998, when I became virally undetectable, I cannot rule out the possibility that I may have infected somebody else. I tried to use condoms, but as we can see from the condom slide, people find it very difficult to manage it all the time. I have to live with that anxiety and that guilt. Certainly a long-term boyfriend of mine did become positive, but it wasn't me. But certainly the first question I had in my mind, perhaps selfishly, when he told me that he'd become positive, was whether I'd essentially done it to him. Okay, right, now let's talk about this balance, as it were. I think one of the things we're talking about is a kind of balance between the physician's responsibility to the patient and the patient's choice over their treatment. And I think we sort of see it in this kind of... This is a sort of drastically simplified version of some of the dilemmas that Jeremy Sugarman was talking about, you know. And this is one version of it, but it's perhaps one that's familiar to the HIV physician. You know, you come along, a patient with the CD4 count of 10, the physician's responsibility to recommend treatment to that patient very, very strongly, everyone would accept. It is, of course, still the patient's right to refuse that treatment and ultimately die if they want to. But as CD4 count creeps up, or as they become kind of less necessarily in need of that treatment themselves, then it becomes not just a question of the strength with which you recommend that treatment or the amount you allocate it to it, but also the amount of choice that the patient has to say yes or no over it. And I think that's very important. One of the things I think that we don't ask, and it was very interesting that the guy from UNAIDS, sorry, I forget your name, came up and actually started talking about a right to prevention, is that it doesn't often get asked whether people want prevention. I'll explain what I mean by that. If you ask people about what they think of the benefits of treatment as prevention, they tend to tell you about the treatment and not the prevention. And so they tend to tell you about their reservations about the treatment. Now, this may not be valid. Some of you may think this isn't valid because it's not about the present situation. This is about a couple of studies where people were asked about what they would feel if there was a cure for HIV. And they've been presented at sequential cure workshops at the International AIDS conferences. And certainly this was presented at Washington. And this was a survey of people living with HIV in the Netherlands, and they were asked about what would they feel if there was a cure for HIV, what would be the most important aspect of that for them. And their health was the most important aspect, but the risk of infecting someone was number three on the list, very high on that list, and certainly above a number of other things, including shorter life expectancy, interestingly. And so 62/3 thought the risk of infecting someone was a very important disadvantage that they would be glad to be relieved of. This is a study from Sharon Lewin from Australia, and this is an actual study of people who were involved in an actual trial of an experimental HIV cure drug. And interestingly, not passing the virus on to others was cited by these people as the most important potential advantage of a cure. So I think sometimes we get confused. We say that treatment of prevention is always a public health measure. Treatment as treatment is of direct benefit to the individual. But I think it's important. It certainly would have been of direct benefit as an individual to me. Obviously, I was very sick before I took the treatment, so I'm very glad it saved my health as well, but it would have been nice not to be infectious too. Okay. Of course, things that matter to doctors and patients are very... They're not different, actually. I think patients and doctors have very largely the same priorities, but we have to... But the doctors do not lead the lives that patients lead, and patients... I'm not expecting you to read all this. It's just a sort of list of contradictory kind of pushes that may be in people's minds, pro or anti taking treatment, whether that is for prevention reasons or for treatment reasons, I don't think it matters. People still have the same reservations about treatment, as I say, whatever their CD4 count. This is an important slide in a sense because it tries to crunch together, I think, the most important concerns around treatment as prevention that go into the debates on this subject. And this is just a selection of quotes, and I am going to read them because I think they're important. So, the side effects. Antiretroviral therapy is a lifelong regimen with potential irreversible side effects. I think that is becoming less of a consideration. And I think, but I think people's perception of ART lags behind that. Very interestingly, I'm not sure if I've included it in the slide, so I'll say it now. There was a study of in IPREX Olay, the very cleverly named open label extension of the IPREX PrEP study. And people who were in the original RCT were entitled to go onto the open label study, but in practice only about half of them did. And when the ones who were asked why not the biggest concern was fear of side effects. And yet, if you actually go deeply into the long-term side effects associated with tenofovir, they're not that terrifying. They add a few percentage to the age-related kidney decline, perhaps, of people who are HIV negative and not on treatment. They may add a bit of osteoporosis, but not a huge... So if the data says the side effects have been relatively slight. The concern says the side effects are potentially huge and irreversible. Efficacy, reducing the viral load of HIV-positive individuals may reduce their potential infectivity. This is an important but secondary issue. That's one of the things we're talking about. It should always be noted that the extent of this reduction in infectivity remains a subject of considerable uncertainty. Behaviour change and public health effects. Certainly one of the things that concerns people have is that the ART-based measures are not going to control STIs, and that may increase infectiousness. Perception of ART, this is really interesting, from Africa, a study in Africa. When you take Cetrine, you consider yourself to be at another stage. You've not reached the final stage of the ARVs. Okay. In other words, taking ARVs is associated with having AIDS, with being a last resort. Public health ethics. There is no precedent outside the criminal justice system where individuals are given drugs for purposes other than their direct benefit. And a directly moral attitude. Medications were not introduced to allow men, in this case of either status, more condom-free sex. They were introduced to save lives. And the other thing we need to consider is that there is a lot of concern among the community about treatment as prevention being taken clumsily and enforced. Essentially, it becomes a kind of thing that they do to us rather than what we take hold of. Partially because there's maybe national misunderstandings and of the potential and practicality of test and treat. There may be enforced treatment as a way of kind of politicians demonstrating to the population that they're in control of despised minorities. It's also sometimes that withholding treatment is also used as a kind of punishment for minorities, such as prisons. Community statements have been used in the past in a situation where the community of people with HIV see the potential for a particular approach but want to develop some kind of control over it. And these are three of them. The Paris Declaration was the one about the which essentially kind of was involved in the founding of GNP Plus. And I think the other two are very familiar. I'm going to rush through. So we developed a community, the idea of a community centre statement, originally born out of the need to revise EHEG prevention policy in general. And although that only appeared in 2009, it had almost nothing to say about treatment as prevention. In fact, it had one little paragraph about the important about research in gay men. So we're trying to basically put a statement together that combines all of these various concerns and others I haven't mentioned. At the moment, it says it's issued with an underlying principle in mind, that of safeguarding people's choices and well-being. It goes through a number of different areas: evidence, adherence, readiness, the advantages and disadvantages of TASP, access and supply of drugs, the challenge to previously accepted norms, how it will affect behaviour, continued condom supply, support and education needs, and unanswered questions and research needs. A couple of quotes. In many countries, the most vulnerable populations that need ART have the worst access to HIV services. The prevention benefits of ART cannot be realised until these are addressed. And a statement of principle about prevention and treatment not being put into competition with each other, which of course doesn't mean in reality they're not. Research gaps, these are the ones we had on the original statement. We wrote the first draft in March. This went round, firstly, an EATG writing group. Then it went to a community consultation online. It was considerably added to. It was sent to an external editor who crunched it down to about 2.5 pages of A4. We started the process of inviting the community to a meeting to talk about it. So yesterday we had 50 attendees from all over Europe and a few from the US representing various populations with evidence, with plenaries from Julio Montaner there, Jane Anderson, and Olga Stefanishina from the Ukrainian community of people living with HIV, a community advisory board, on giving us a very sort of real instance of the struggles for access they've had over there. Okay. All right. Basically, this is the feedback we have, which we will add into the statement. People were very concerned that we placed the statement in a broader context of human rights and underlying values. I'll skip down to number 4. It emphasises safeguarding people's choices, but some people have none. Rights and dignity precede choice, and I think that's absolutely correct, and we need to say that. TASP is an example of think global, act local. There are these overall scientific principles. They may be complete, they may mean nothing in local situations where they can't be applied. We need always to speak to the science, but it's important to speak to the people who don't understand the science. Be explicit what the statement is about and not about. Treatment access in general is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the implications of TASP. And I think most of the rest have been covered by me or by Jeremy. Specific populations, the community advantage of TASP as well as the individual advantage, and implementation research into the exact mix that is most effective for specific locations, populations, and people. We need to find out about what TASP is doing as we go along doing it. And that applies to virtually every prevention method I can think of. Anyway, if I don't stop now, I won't give people time to talk. We hope to have a finished document by the end of the year for people to sign on to. And there's a thank you slide.
Thanks for that, Gus. Unless anybody has any questions relating specifically to a few issues in that slide, we'll move on and wait till a wider discussion amongst the panel. So from here on in, I think we'll go forward through the panel, and we'll start off with Anna Zakovic. They're all just going to give maybe 3 minutes on what their take is on tasks from a community perspective and the implementation of it. So I'll start. And then at the end of all of that, we can have a discussion. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Is it working? Okay. Yeah, it is. All right. Okay. So I would like to take a perspective from a consumer perspective as a woman who lives with HIV, but the person who also has experience of injecting drugs, using the drugs in Eastern Europe, and then also a perspective of the provider, service provider, because in the present work that I do, I have a chance to provide services to the populations that need the services. So first, I think it's very important that we are going to have the research HPTN-074 study in Eastern Europe and Central Asia that will look how treatment... How treatment can be used as prevention in the communities, but I think it's very important that we don't make a mistake that was done with the Bangkok study, when actually the unethical approach was used, where and I'm sure all of you know this study, where golden standards of harm reduction were not used, and actually the approach was not really realistic when we talked about providing PrEP, because it was a PrEP study. I'm sorry, I'm a little bit stressed out. So it was a PrEP study, and there was no needle and syringe programs there was no needle and syringe OST, which is golden standard, because of the politics. So I think we need to be really very cautious when we choose the sites, that the politics and in Eastern Europe and Central Asia does not influence the research that we are going to do it, because we are going to do the research to use it later on. And then yesterday there was fantastic session on the models, looking at Eastern European perspective, there is only one model that I know done by Peter Vickerman at London School of Hygiene, and probably it's not, well, this model could be improved because it really does not take into consideration sexual networks, as people who use drugs do not have sex, and also assuming that the adherence for people who use drugs is very low. So I think we need to have more models, and if there is some discussions between or if there are any groups that are being formed to look into this, because we really looked at the British Columbia experience, but the question in Eastern Europe is, does it really work for us, or will it work for us in the situation that we are now? And then implementation, I think, I don't want to talk about oppression and violence towards women and key populations, and I think that's why we have this this term of community involvement in HIV, but I think looking at the situation that is right now, the community involvement is still wishful thinking, and we really not take very seriously how people who live with HIV or who are sex workers, who use drugs, how then they can be really meaningfully involved in addressing the epidemic. We allow communities, yes, to link people to care, maybe to do some outreach, maybe to do some adherence stuff, but I think we are not really allowing people who know what the issues are to take the initiatives. And I think comparing Africa and countries with high income, Africa is sometimes much more developed. For example, looking at testing, who can do testing? In Europe, for example, we are not allowed to do testing, so we need to do use medical professionals, and we are not taken seriously when we want to open clinics. So I think I believe that we can do as much as we can do. So I think that the community, we will continue to do testing, though it's illegal. We can go, we can get imprisoned, which will make the case, showing that, okay, we want to deal with the epidemic, but there are different barriers that hinder it. But I think there is also a question to the group of physicians, to IPAC as well, that to all of you, because I think we need a revolution in thinking and revolution in approach. And I think we need the union of physicians to take a strong standpoint on that. And we need a movement also from your side saying, giving us the power also to deal with the epidemic.
Thank you, Anna. Going to you, Cornelius, thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Cornelius Baker, and I come from the United States. And the framework that I'd like to approach this from is first reminding us all that while the United States is a high-income country, the epidemic is concentrated in its poorest citizens, in its most marginalized, because of the issues of both homophobia and racism. And that the epidemic is even more concentrated these days in the southern United States of the southern United States, which of course is the poorest region of our country, and where citizens continue to be denied their most basic human and civil rights on a daily basis. So, thinking then about how we approach the issue, and what I would also say is that, again, to remind ourselves that the United States does not offer universal health care to its citizens, and our House of Representatives continues to try to defund daily the advances of President Obama to provide more health care. So thinking in that context, then, what does treatment as prevention mean from a United States perspective as we collaborate with our European colleagues on this consensus statement? The first, I think, is that we should always validate the science. And so we have to lead from the perspective that this is an important study that gives us important results, and that it's important to communicate those results to the population without bias. And that from there, we can then begin to look at what is the value and meaning of that science. I think that the first is that obviously, if this is implemented widely, and if we had the resources to provide treatment to every person over a period of time, if that treatment was successful, we would see a tremendous reduction in the epidemic. However, we also have to be careful, because of those presumptions, not to oversell the science to either the community or to the public. We must recognize the limitations of the science without undermining the science. There are very real concerns about side effects, about the potential of the drugs. A lot of these are based on historical nature of the drug, of where we've been in the development of drugs, and we have not always kept pace in providing scientific literacy or engagement with the community so that they have a good understanding of where we are. Perhaps an analogy for this, which the world is looking at right now, is the issue of Syria. Clearly, the world is rejecting the concept of war. But the world is largely rejecting the concept of war because of the last war and the lies that were told during the last war. Now, whether that situation is relevant to our current situation is not clear. And I'm not debating the rightness or the wrongness of the issue of Syria. But the assumptions that people are making may not be based on the current. And so we have a responsibility to always make the case for drugs, for treatment, for all of our advances in science in real time. We can't go to communities after the fact and then tell them to trust us, particularly poor and marginalized communities, because why should they blindly trust? So that is our first challenge. But we've also been here before, and I think that that's also a secondary lesson for us to think about in the context of this consensus statement. Many of the arguments that we are making were also being made, or the disagreements or the concerns were being made at the time of the ACTG AIDS clinical trial 076 results. And so that was actually the first proof that treatment was prevention. And we had concerns about coercion of pregnant women, about how would we actually get people tested, about the rollout of it, what was the affordability. Now, clearly, MTC is a short-term intervention. But we still have many of the same complicated results, access to it, identification of patients, adherence to it, keeping people in care, and the social and economic circumstances in which a person will need the treatment, and most importantly, their child. When we think about it, look back on earlier this year, the Mississippi Cured Baby study. Now, here we had a pregnant woman who was in a healthcare system but was residing in Mississippi, a poor state. She was a poor woman with a substance use history and difficulty and challenges around transportation. And that child and the mother were lost to care. And while we can celebrate the fact that there was a cure, presumably, there was also an enormous opportunity for prevention, which was missed. And we have to go back and look at what can we learn from that in terms of informing us about how successful or not we can be around treatment as prevention if we cannot keep a mother for 9 months in our care. Lastly, I will go to the issue of human rights and how we approach the issues of treatment as prevention, and to recognize that issues of coercion, issues of access, issue of all of those things are very, very important, but that we need to also approach the framework that for many people with HIV, the issues of treatment as prevention are very academic. When they come to our systems of care, they are already in need of treatment. And while we hope to improve that, we haven't gotten to that point yet. And we're not providing people with the care that they deserve today. So, in effect, the real issue isn't how do we scale up treatment as prevention, but how do we scale up treatment so that it can have a prevention effect?
Thank you. Now we go over to Nikos, please. Could we try and stick to 3 minutes?
Yes, I will. So, I would like to pick on one thing that Cornelius said, that we should not oversell the impact of treatment for prevention. But what I would like to say is that we shouldn't also undersell the impact of treatment as prevention. And you also said at one point that science has its limitations, and I think good science has no limitations, but our interpretation of the science has definitely a couple of limitations. I want to make four very short points. One has to do with the impact of the scientific data in the life of people who live with HIV, 2 points on public health, and one about the process of science. About the first point on the impact of to people who live with HIV, this has been made many times, but I would like also to raise it again in response to the presentation that Professor Sugarman gave. What he said is that we should not over-medicalize the life of a person who lives with HIV before that is necessary. And indeed, for many people, medicalization is a painful reminder of their status and what it means to be living with HIV. But I can assure you that when I was diagnosed in a period in the mid-90s when HIV was still a terminal disease, what for me was the most horrific thing that I had to deal with, given that I was not diagnosed with five CD4s, was not the extent of my life and the duration of the remaining years, but what would be the impact for my personal relations, for my sexual partners, for a potential partner. So I think that the benefit that this data has is not sufficiently communicated to people living with HIV, and this is a responsibility that both we from the community have, but this is also a responsibility of the doctors. It has now been included in all guidelines, but it is, from what we know, doctors do not actively discuss this at the medical practice. This is a responsibility. Obviously, treatment should not be offered if there's a waiting line for people who need treatment in order to survive. And we will hear more about that from Kenley. The two points I want to make about the public health is, once again, the treatment as prevention is pitted against, there are these things that people say that it will have a negative result. For me, the data are demonstrating where transmission is taking place and where transmission is not taking place. This is a very important piece of information for all of us who are involved in prevention. And of course, we still need to have more clarity on what is the contribution of the period of seroconversion versus the period of chronic state. But it is also clear that when on treatment, you are not infectious. The third point about public health is that we have all seen the cascade. We now know through this data that the left side of the cascade is where we should put all our efforts in order to reap the benefits of the right side, which is the treatment. In other words, we must make sure that we have the appropriate diagnosis, the appropriate linkage to care, the retention to care, in order to be able to benefit from treatment as prevention. Therefore, again, the data tell us that this is what we should be doing. Finally, I have been hearing about all these research gaps. What I would plea from this 2 days meeting is that we actually have a list of all these gaps and we follow them and tick the boxes as that someone is actually doing something about it, because I'm sick and tired of hearing about we do not know what happens in the seminal fluids when we are on treatment, which we heard today again from WAFA. This was a question that was raised back in 2008 when the Swiss statement came out. It certainly became more pressing when the data came out in 2011. It's unacceptable that we do not know what is the impact of treatment in the seminal fluids. Thank you.
Thank you, Nikos. I think when you speak about generalized epidemics such as ours in Southern Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa, the issue of treatment as prevention is a reality. And I'm glad that Ruben clarified the definition that WHO is using for its new guidelines. That is a very pertinent one when you look at treatment as prevention from that perspective. That is not only just about prevention of transmission, but it also is about transmission, it's about prevention from infection. And when you have endemic diseases such as TB in our region, that's very, very critical. And of course, it's also prevention from death. So the issue of treatment as prevention cannot be overemphasized in our region. I'll give you very typical examples, and I'm glad Nikos has covered the general public health issues, for instance. In some parts of Africa now, you have epidemics or pockets of epidemics which with a prevalence of 40-45%. Now, how else can you begin to deal with those levels of viral loads in the public, apart from considering all available prevention tools available to you? And at the moment, one of the most effective prevention tools that we have is, of course, the use of ARVs. And this is why I think the issue of scaling up treatment as prevention, we shouldn't need to apologize or explain it. And I think the other need that was mentioned earlier, the issue of ethical and ethical issues, the equity issues are critical. I still want African people living with HIV to have the same access choices as people that do in the North. And that cannot, that must be a driving factor. There will be areas that will be, or that will always exist, that will be difficult to reach. They will be difficult to reach not because the ARVs are not accessible or services, it's just the way the structural makeup of the countries are, that they are difficult to reach because of the hugeness of the countries and the pure transport infrastructures that exist. So what people now in living with HIV are saying is basically that we need to target primarily women living with HIV, save babies from dying from HIV and getting infected from HIV, save with a high heterosexual transmission, prevent people living with HIV transmitting HIV to their partners, reduce the incidence of TB, which has been rising and is not, you know, hasn't been dropping. So these are the issues that are important for us when we speak about treatment as prevention. So let's lead the discussion rather than, you know, leading from behind. And I want to just end this with this point that we heard from the Minister of Health from Malawi yesterday, where she said, in fact, we have come to a place where we need to speak about test and treat. Now, that's very, very important, because if the politicians or policymakers lead that conversation, it will mean a different thing, because the human rights issues will not be taken into consideration. There will be issues of real cohesion, possibilities of real cohesion and so on. So if you lead that process, if we lead that process as communities and clinicians together, then we can make sure that treatment as prevention, or if it does go to test and treat, in those very high burden areas are manageable and controllable. Thank you.
Right, thanks very much for that to everybody there. Do we have any questions from the floor, or any issues that you'd like to bring up at this point? One going towards the back there. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the lucid presentations that have just been made. My name is Atiene Sage. I'm from Jos in Nigeria. First and foremost, I first want to acknowledge that all treatment should actually be for prevention. All treatment, whether it is treatment of diabetes or hypertension or whatever, it is actually to prevent something. It depends on what you are preventing, whether you are preventing complications or you are preventing death. So all treatment is actually for prevention. It is true that concerning HIV, because of the cost of treatment, people have tried to make exceptions here and there. Now that the drugs have become reasonably cheap, the main question I want to put then is, given the benefits that we have seen in the emerging, obviously, from the British Columbia approach of see and treat, when will it become unethical to withhold the option of lifelong treatment to those who prefer that approach? You know, so if you don't give them that option, you know, when will that be considered unethical? That is just the question. Thank you.
Would anyone like to answer that?
I can if you like, so I'm not whispering to Anna. I mean, in some ways, yes. All treatment is prevention. I think things changed things have been changing as the treatment thresholds have been raised, and as the situation became possible where we didn't just have to give ARVs to people who were going to die unless they got them, but we started giving them to people who were already not particularly sick and maybe could wait quite a few more years until they got them. And I think that starts to sort of then blur the boundaries between saying, there is a difference between giving them to people who are going to die unless they get them and giving them to people who may not need them at all, but in order to prevent them passing it on. So in a way, I'm saying, yes, I agree with you. It's not a starkly divided field, there is a sort of blurred line between it.
Any other comments at the moment on that one? No? Any other yes. Andrew.
Can I ask a question about thinking of the situation in sub-Saharan African countries, which we know that availability of CD4 counting, the staging, is kind of patchy in some countries, hardly available at all. And so there's a situation where essentially, we talk about deferral strategies for antiretroviral therapy, following people to CD4 count until it reaches a certain level at which we say now we're sure that the benefits outweigh the risk for your health, and so we'll start treatment. But it's quite clear that in many countries, in practice, it's actually not possible to implement such a deferral strategy. So the choices then are sort of when you first see a person who's diagnosed with HIV, there's a risk of losing them until they're sick. But on the other hand, if you just say, I'm going to start treatment, there's a potential, a small risk for that person that actually they didn't actually need to start treatment, certainly not yet. In those circumstances, would you say that it's acceptable as a public health approach to say we're just going to treat everyone because we cannot, we don't have the means to actually defer, to actually measure CD4 counts and defer until it's actually needed? So I'd be interested in hearing people's views about that.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's an important point, because I think we heard yesterday in one of the presentations, one of the biggest challenges even now, even when we talk about initiating from 350 to 500, people are still initiating, let's maybe talk about 350. People were still initiating way, way below 200. And usually the means of diagnosing people living with HIV was if they showed up with some kind of comorbidity. And so, in fact, that is where I think the whole issue of, I think the governments, when they speak about test and treat, is becoming attractive to them. That, look, if people are being brought into care when they're sick, why don't we just make testing compulsory, again, which is dangerous. I think we saw the slide from the SADC president saying, why don't we have a test and treat approach, which in their understanding, they think if we test every household and we find people are positive, we put them on treatment straight away, then we can bring the prevalence down and the disease burden and all these issues. And this is where we're having a real, real challenge. So if we begin that discussion ourselves, this is why I try to emphasize that point, that if we lead the discussion ourselves as clinicians, as community people, and manage that process, then I think we may begin to manage it much better, so that we only begin to initiate people who actually want to start treatment, not those who are not ready. For instance, if their CD4 is 800 and they choose not to start treatment, then we shouldn't have to force them. But there might be others who might say, well, I'm not in a relationship, but I would still like to start treatment because I think that the benefits far outweigh the risks. Then there should be that option, because if you let them go, you're quite right. The next time you see them is when they show up in your clinic in a wheelchair with a TB diagnosis.
Nikos, did you have a very brief comment?
Well, what I want to say is that, of course, in the absence of availability of CD4 count, or indeed the possibility of being able to visit often, which, as we know, it's very difficult, I think that the benefits outweigh the risk of initiating treatment is, I think, the best public health approach. And, of course, this decision should be given to the individual. The individual should be informed about the potential harm, but also the benefit of stopping the further infection. The other thing is that there's been a little bit of a controversy with the guidelines. So there are some people, obviously WHO has reviewed the evidence and has decided on 500. There are others who contest that. But what I would say is that if so many people made the mistake of interpreting the data in this way, it means that we're talking about a very, very slight level of confidence, which is not there. So I think that from the medical side, the equipoise is definitely there to start people from 500, and I doubt that many people are diagnosed with 800 CD4.
Thanks. Last comment over there. Thank you.
Hi, Ben Young from IAPAC. This is a question and really perhaps a chance for commentary from Anna. You raised the point, and I think gave us the opportunity from IAPAC to, as you said, I think the words were something to ask for a revolution of healthcare providers. And I wanted to give you the opportunity to expound a little further on that. As the chief medical officer of IAPAC, I represent in principle 17 or 20,000 healthcare providers of HIV around the world. And I really want, one, to personally hear your commentary and really welcome the panel's commentary on what do we need to get these voices, your voices, heard on the ground in Geneva and in Washington and in Atlanta, but also on the ground in sub-Saharan Africa or in Eastern Europe and Central Asia.
Just before we go into the response here, can I just say that was the last comment, so sorry, I think we have to be breaking for lunch. And Anna, can I actually say, can we have a one-minute reply?
Yeah, because I think the question is really... The question and the problem is actually really, really broad, because you need to look at different levels, at the grassroots level and then also at the healthcare providers level, and then also at the legal perspective. So I think probably, there is a question about involvement, but the question is how the involvement is there. And then on the other hand, we are all the community, right? And we are all, and we can all be providers. So I think probably it's better that we like talk together maybe during the break, because I think there are a lot of like ways that it can be improved. But I think now a golden opportunity is the IPAC guidelines that IPAC is working on testing and linkage to care and retention and care and adherence. So I think, there are a few people from the community who are involved in the development of the guidelines, but I think if this can be done, I mean, if the voices of the community can be heard, and also using other ways that community does consultation, and then this can be included in the guidelines, I think it will be the first good step.
Right. Thanks very much to everybody. Thanks to all of the panelists, and thanks to the presenter. And I think it's time for your lunch now. Yep. Thank you.
Yeah, no, and thank you, Paul.